Thank you, Connie, I think. I wonder why she wanted me to put that dress on backstage. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. And I am delighted to be here. I really do want to thank Connie and Steve and the rest of the committee for inviting me. It's always a great pleasure and an honor to be invited to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've just had the best time since I've been here. I always do when I come down to Southern Florida. And you have a spirit about you that's really something. I was just amazed the number of people who were fed here and everything's on time. Can you imagine if we were drinking? Good Lord. I bring you greetings from my wife, Julia, the lovely Julia, who's home, saying a prayer for you. She really is. She prays the hour that I talk whenever I'm away. She figures out that if there's a time change and everything. And I told her, I said, you know, that's really nice, honey, that you'd pray for me for an hour. She said, I'm praying for the people who listen to you. So. And I bring you greetings from my home group. My home group is the Midtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Wilmington, North Carolina. And if you ever get a chance to come to Wilmington, you're certainly invited. We meet on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock. Our meetings go from 7 until 8. And if you come on Thursday, you want to come down to the probation office with us, you're welcome to do that. We sponsor a meeting in the probation office. Not a happy bunch, but we snag a few from time to time. It's just great to be here. I can't tell you. A few guys took me out this morning. We played golf. They put up with my golf swing and the bad jokes and everything. And it's just great to be here. I can't thank you enough for that. I'm always impressed with countdowns. But you know, you got a lot of sobriety down here, and I congratulate the newcomer who got the book, and I really want to congratulate the old-timer, Jim, who gave the book. But I'd like to, if I could, just before I get started, I'd like to say a word or two to the new people about old-timers. We don't give advice in Alcoholics Anonymous, but if I were to give advice, I'd tell you, stay away from the old-timers. They're really not nice people. They really aren't. They mean well, but one of the things they do is they lie. They do. They say things like, you know, we go to meetings because we need to. That's a lie. They don't need to go to meetings. The only reason they go to meetings is the only enjoyment they get out of life is watching people like you and me suffer. That's right. And whenever you, if you don't believe me, go to one of the old timers after the meeting and tell them a problem. First thing they do is laugh. And if you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. They love problems about sex, you know. And they always say the same thing. They always say, no sex. Isn't that right? Yeah. They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have sex either. Yeah. I live in North Carolina now, but I was born in a small town in Ohio, just south of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a little town called Martin's Ferry. If you hadn't been there, I wouldn't bother. It's been canceled. But I'm the second child, the eldest son in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church I went to. You'll have to guess. I give you a hint, it has something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to say any more. And you know, I'd have told you that I grew up in poverty. The problem with that is that I would have been wrong. What I grew up with was a lack of material things. That's what I grew up with. But I certainly didn't grow up with poverty. And I'll tell you why. Because I had a mother who every day I let her, she'd hug me and kiss me and tell me that she loved me. And I had a father that every day I would let him would spend time with me, either playing baseball or teaching me to play checkers or doing something. So I was fabulously wealthy. I had brothers and sisters to play with and all kinds of things. I grew up with great wealth. The problem was that I had a spiritual condition, and that spiritual condition was to stay with me until I found you, and that spiritual condition was fear. I was a kid who was afraid, and I think I was born afraid. I don't remember. But from the earliest recollection, I was afraid. I'll give you an example. I had something lived under my bed. I don't know if they have any of those things in Florida. But they had a lot of them in Ohio, and it lived under my bed, and at night I could hear it. It'd be moving around down there, and I knew what it was doing. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed, and that's history. And I knew that, you know, and so I used to try to lay right in the middle of the bed, and I used to try to be real small so that it couldn't get me. And that isn't a normal way to live, I've discovered later, but I didn't know because it was the only way I knew to live. I was also a kid who had a horrible speech impediment, and no one could understand me except the people who loved me the most, and they treated me like I was normal. And then I went off to school, and I'll never forget this. I was in the first grade, and the nun asked a question. She said, "Is there anybody here?" It was the first day of class, and all the parents were there. She said, "Is there anybody here who can sing us a song?" Well, I used to sing songs, and my mother told me that I was a very good singer, and so I put my hand up, and my mother immediately began to drift back into the crowd of parents, and I remember I stood up and I sang that classic, "I'm a gand old fag, I'm a high fine fag," and my mother said it was one of the most beautiful things she had ever heard in her life, I was a kid who tried to fit in. I just never understood what was going on. And if I had known you didn't understand what was going on, too, it would have been all right. But I thought you knew. You always look so confident. You know, you always look like you know exactly what was going on. And I thought I was the only guy who didn't understand a big picture. And I thought my job was to guess at what life was like. And I used to watch you very carefully. And I'd do exactly what you did because you knew what was going on, and I didn't, and I tried to fit in as best I could, and somewhere in high school, I guess, it occurred to me that I wasn't very good at being very good, so I tried to be bad, and I wasn't good at being bad either, but I got myself into a lot of trouble in high school, and not bad things, just pranks and things like that, and I went to this small Catholic high school in Belair, Ohio, and when you got into trouble, you used to spend time with Sister Victoria. Sister Victoria was a librarian, and she was a weird little nun. She used to run around saying things like, "Every boy's a prince and every girl's a princess because we have a father who's a king." That's really weird. And so we used to make fun of her and call each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary and things like that. And when you got in trouble, you used to serve detention in a library with Sister Victoria. And you had to make rosary beads. And what they do is give you wire and fires and beads. And you make these rosary beads. And rosary beads are things that Catholics pray on. And they're made up of five groups of 10 beads in each decade. And I spent many hours with Sister Victoria. And she used to put me behind a magazine rack. She said I was a prince, but I was contagious. So she'd put me behind a rack. And I'm making rosary beads for 4 years, and my rosary beads were different than other people's rosary beads. Mine had 11 beads in each of the decades, and I made hundreds of mutant rosary beads. They're all over the world. They'd send them to the missions around the world, and it was time to graduate. You know, you can't not let them know. So I went to see Sister Victoria, and I said to her, "You know what I've been doing the last 4 years?" And she said, "Yes, you sly little prince. You've been making rosary beads with..." She said, "I know what you've been doing, and I know why you've been doing it." And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest notion of why I do these things. And she said, "You're making these things so that people all over the world will pray extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit." Don't you hate people like that, you know? And then she said something to me that terrified me, because I was a kid who had worked very, very hard to speak well enough to be understood. And she took both of her hands in my hand, and she had that. She was a spiritual person. She's like an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they look you in the eye. You're not a bit interested in looking them in the eye, but they look you in the eye anyway. And it's like they look deep down inside of you, and that's what she did to me. And she said, "You know, son," she said, "you're very special, and one day God's going to send you all over the world telling his children how very much he loves them. So I just want you to know that God loves you very much." You know, I graduated from high school, and I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. It seemed to me everybody else knew what they were going to do, but I had no idea what I was going to do. And so what I knew was I had to go away, because if you go away, they won't know you don't know what you're doing. They'll think you're doing it. So the way you go away was you join the service. So I went home and I took one of my very first inventories. I took my shirt off and I stood in front of the mirror and I flexed my muscles and I turned sideways and I stuck my chest out, and I was 5 feet 1 inch tall and I weighed 113 pounds. Whatever else I was a born killer. So I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia and joined the Marine Corps. Now the problem with that was that, one, I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps. And the second thing was that I failed to tell my parents. And I wasn't yet 18, so they had to sign for me to go. Well, the recruiter showed up with the papers, and my parents just lost it. My poor mother, God rest her soul, she cried all night. And she kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." So with that vote of confidence, the next morning, I got on a taxi cab and we went over to the bus station in Wheeling, West Virginia, and I got on a Greyhound bus and went to Pittsburgh. Now, Pittsburgh's 60 miles away, and it's the second longest trip I'd ever been on. You know, so here's a worldly guy going off to war, and it was a very bad year, and they took you if you had a pulse. So I had a pulse, so that afternoon I was sworn into the Marine Corps. And the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps was they took a certain number of young men down to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp. See, the only thing that I knew, and three guys from Pittsburgh joined, and they were big guys. They knew what was going on. They understood the whole picture, so I decided to follow them. And they said, "We got 8 hours before the train leaves. We're going to go over to a bar and have a few drinks. You want to join us?" I said, "That's just what I was thinking about, going over to the bar and having a few drinks, and we might as well go together." So I followed them over to the bar, and that's where my life changed. And if you're alcoholic, you know exactly what I mean. If you're alcoholic, there was one day in your life when something happened that was to fashion or form the rest of your life. And that night, in 1961, I was inexorably changed. I was to have an experience that would change me forever. And I walked into a bar behind these guys in Pittsburgh, and I couldn't tell you where the bar was. I have no idea. But it was a bar filled with real men, you know the kind. And they all have real women with them. Real women hang around with real men. And guys like me used to get what was left. And I followed him in there, and the bartender came over. And you know how they ask questions. He said, "What do you want?" And I thought, oh my God, a quiz. I don't know why. I always thought that life was a place where when you least expected it, somebody was going to give you a quiz. And I didn't know what to say, and I watched these other guys, and they knew exactly what to say. They ordered a beer, and so I did too. And then the guy came back, and he asked the same question. They gave the same answer. And he came back the third time, and I knew the answer. And something happened to me between the second and third drink, and I'll tell you, I stood up. I didn't mean to stand up. I just couldn't keep from standing up. I just stood up. And the floor was 6 feet 4 inches below me. And my right shoulder was out there. My left shoulder was out there. And the muscles were rippling through my body. It was an amazing thing. You know? And I looked around that room. And the room was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. And all of them had women with them or looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it, you know. It was an incredible experience. It was just amazing. But even better than that, for the first time in my entire life, my mind was perfectly clear, and I understood the big picture for the very first time. I knew all about God. I knew all about women. I knew all about being a real man. I mean, I knew stuff that an hour before I couldn't even guess at. And it was an incredible experience. And I remember this room was filled with a bunch of poor, dumb people. And I remember I was just going from table to table, filling them in. I was answering questions they didn't even come up with. It was an amazing experience. I never had an experience like this in my life. I never felt that important or that anything in my entire life. And it was about 11 o'clock, and the train left at midnight. We had to go, and it seemed to me, now this may not be 100% accurate, but it seemed to me that they were crying and asking me to please stay. Now, maybe they weren't, but it seemed that way to me. And I said, no, I have to go, because I have to go make the world safe for democracy. So we went down, and I got on a train. Now, I assume I got on a train, because the next morning I was on a train. Now, I was to make that assumption many times over the next years, but I woke up on this train. So I must have gotten on the train, and I was in Pittsburgh, so I assume I was in Pittsburgh when I got on the train. And a funny thing happened to me. I was lying on the floor of the Pullman coach the Marine Corps had provided me with, and someone had wet the floor I was lying on. And whoever it was had wet me too. And that reminds me of my first drinking experience. I'd like to talk about my first drinking experience. This was my second drinking experience. My first drinking experience happened when I was 5 years old. I was at home. I didn't go out a lot when I was five. And I was at home with my dad and my dumb brother, Denny. Denny's a year younger than I am. And dumb Denny and Dad and I were sitting around a table playing bug or something. And Mom was away. She was either at the bingo or having a baby. And I think Dad thought it'd be kind of cute, so he got me and Dumb Denny a beer, and he got a beer. And I just think, I thought it'd be funny to see what would happen. Well, nothing happened to me. I was fine. I drank it. I was fine. Nothing at all. I was fine. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening. He slid out of the chair, and he was rolling around under the table, and he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs, And my dad panicked, and he wrestled him to the ground, and he got his clothes off, and he put his jammies on, and he took him up to bed. And Denny was laughing and carrying on and just having the best time. And he said, don't tell your mother about this. And he said, I'll take you to a movie. Well, when you're five, they don't negotiate much with you. So I was game, but Denny wasn't hearing it. He was having the best time. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. Little Denny stood up in his crib, and he urinated on the floor. And I remember thinking, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. The strangest thing happened to Denny. We're not proud of this, but Denny just never developed beyond that. It was like he just, Well, I'll tell you some of the odd things he did. Denny went to one college. And he had one major. It gets worse. He graduated in 4 years. Went to one graduate school. Right? Graduated top in his class. And he was offered like eight jobs, and he took one. And a year ago in October, he retired as a vice president of a large international corporation. And the strangest thing of all was he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he let it slip through his fingers, I had to work at this thing. I was 17 years old before I urinated on the floor for the first time. The morning I woke up on the train, I had forgotten or lost what I had the night before. And again, I was 17 years old, and I was little and skinny and dumb and all the things that goes with that. And the guys were waiting outside the train, and I got off the train, and they said, we're going to go up and have a few beers. Do you want to join us? And I said, well, sure. Just what I was thinking. So I followed him over to the Monaco, and we began to drink beer. And that night, that evening, I fell off the train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. Somebody moved a bottom step or something, but I fell across the next set of railroad tracks. And there was a very rude man there who they sent to greet us. And he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who had gone down there to die for their country. And they called him a drill instructor. And I remember getting up and trying to explain to this cretin that he'd get a lot more out of us if he treated us with a little respect. And he never seemed to grasp. He was a very limited man. He never seemed to grasp exactly what it was I was trying to tell him. And they say you can learn from every experience. And I'll tell you what I learned. You can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned. And I'll tell you something else. I don't mean to be indelicate after dinner, but you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time. And so I was launched into the Marine Corps, and I loved everything about the Marine Corps. I mean it. Everything about the Marine Corps, I just loved it. And I think I've often thought about it, you know, why. I mean, clearly I'm insane, but beyond that, why did I feel so comfortable? Even in boot camp. I loved boot camp. And I think I figured it out. For the very first time in my life, I knew exactly what was expected of me. I knew my job description. And the first 17 years of my life, I guessed at my job description. I had no earthly idea what was expected. But the Marine Corps has a very clear notion of what it is they want from you. And they're not a bit hesitant about sharing it with you. And so I fit in nicely, and it just seemed to make such perfect sense for me. And I won all these things out of boot camp. I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award and all this stuff. And I grew a few inches, and I packed on about 30 pounds. And it was a wonderful experience for me. And I made up my mind that I was going to spend the rest of my life in the Marine Corps. I was going to stay until they told me I had to leave. I mean, that's how I felt about it. And the problem was I was alcoholic. And which means I was a great starter. And, you know, I ended up being the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps. And my goal was to get commissioned as an officer. And I was going to be the youngest officer in the Marine Corps. And things were going along swimmingly. The problem was I was alcoholic. And let me tell you what I think being alcoholic means. For me, being alcoholic means that I have a tremendous excitement about something. You know, playing golf, anything. I'm really excited about it. But being an alcoholic means that I'll throw myself into a way of life, and I'll either gradually or not so gradually violate every principle associated with that way of life. Then I'll leave that life, and I'll blame them for what happened to me. And that's what happened in the Marine Corps. I violated every principle associated with being a Marine, up to and including leading a patrol in combat in a blackout. I don't remember going out. I don't remember coming back. By the grace of God, nobody was killed. And I got out of the Marine Corps, and I blamed them for what had happened to me. And that's the story of my alcoholism. That's what alcoholism was for me. I did these horrendous, horrible things. I violated every principle associated with being a husband. And I got out of the marriage, and I blamed my wife for what had happened to me. And that's it. And I don't want to spend a lot of time telling you how I was drunk, because I assume that most of the people here know something about being drunk. I will talk for a minute, if I could, about how I discovered how powerless I was over alcohol. I have two daughters. Kelly is the oldest, and Kimberly was the second daughter to be born. And when Kimberly was to be delivered, I was passed out on a living room floor, which isn't unusual. I was passed out on a living room floor about every night. I was watching a test pattern or something on the TV. And my wife decided it was time to have the baby, which really irritated me, because I knew if she'd have waited, if she'd have had the baby at the right time, I'd have been all right, you know. But she'd had to carry that kid for 3 years. She finally woke me up. They invited the neighbors over. Wives will do that. They invite neighbors over to see you lying in your underwear watching a test pattern. And she had thrown water and things on me to wake me up, and a poor woman was just hysterical. And finally I woke up, and she said the baby was coming, and I said, the baby can't be coming. It's not due for another 3 months. And she said, tell the baby. And so I put her in a car, and I rushed off to the hospital I worked in. I was drunk, and we went in the emergency room, and I was demanding they take care of my wife, which was really odd because, you know, I didn't show her any respect at all, but I expected everybody else to. And I was drunk, and it was embarrassing. And little Kimberly was born, and Kimberly weighed about a pound and a half. And she had something called hyaline membrane disease, which is kids commonly live with now, but then it was as bad as she was, they never lived. And 3 days before she was born, they had gotten I was at Georgetown University Hospital, and they had gotten an experimental machine called a negative respirator, very common now. But it was the first one on the East Coast. And the day before she was born, an engineer and a resident who I'd gone to high school with in Ohio came in and put it together. And so the day that my daughter was born, they put her on it. And I discovered just how isolated and alone I had become with this spiritual illness called alcoholism. Our offices were across from the neonatal nursery, and I would sit in there at night with the lights out and the door slightly cracked, and I'd watch this little thing struggle for every breath. And when these kids are on these respirators, their little bodies almost lift up. It's called retracting, and they almost lift up. And I'm watching this little thing struggle for every breath, and she terrified me. I was scared to death of this little thing, and it occurred to me that if God found out I liked this kid, that he would take her. And because that's the way it seemed to me. It seemed that everything I liked was being taken from me. And the coward that I was, I cowered in that dark room. And I remember at 72 hours, it's a very critical time for these kids. And I remember my wife, who at this time was in a state of shock. She had a 1,000-yard stare. She'd just walk up and down the hospital corridor looking in the nursery. And I remember the evening she went in because they didn't think Kimmy would live, and she baptized her. And everything inside of me wanted to run in and put my arms around them and tell them that it would be okay and I was there. Because I watched my dad do that. My dad knew how to be a dad, and I knew how to be a dad because I watched him. And you know, my parents raised their 11 children, and they raised kids who didn't have any place else to go. And I'm cowering in the dark in an office. And I hadn't been to church in a while. I'd basically given up on God. And Georgetown's a Catholic hospital and have a chapel. Last-ditch desperate measure, I ran down to that chapel. And I got on my knees in front of the tabernacle. And, you know, as a kid growing up, the tabernacle was a very special place. And I got on my knees and I begged God to let this little girl live. And I said, I'll do anything if you'll let her live. If you'll let her live, I'll stop drinking. And I was drunk in 12 hours. Now, I drank when I thought drinking would kill my little girl. Well, Blaise Pascal, the great French philosopher, says that God created man in his own image, and unfortunately, man returned a favor. And that's what I had done. I had created a God who would kill a little kid because her dad was sick. And God isn't like that. They told me that she would be retarded if she lived, and she graduated with honors from Auburn University. And I always tell her, I think you can be retarded and graduate with honors from Auburn University, but she's just a delightful young lady, and this past Christmas she presented me with my first grandchild, and something for which I am extremely grateful. But and they live up in Daphne, Alabama, and she married a really neat kid who's a dentist, and it's just great to watch them. And you know, as sick as I was, one day, you know, my wife had to say to me, "We can't live like this." She said, "I can't even go to work. I'm afraid you're going to burn the place down and with cigarettes and alcohol and this and that." And the insanity was so great. Now, let me give you an example of how crazy it got in our marriage. I was out drunk, and I was out drunk about every night, but I was drunk this one night, and we had started over again for the 14th time or something like that, and the way you start over is you take the children to grandma's house, and grandma watches the children, and you start over, and what we would do is I'd swear I wouldn't drink too much, and the first night we'd go out to dinner, and I'd have maybe 2-3 drinks, and we'd come home, and she'd bought some negligees and things, and we go off to bed, and she'd put one of those things on, and we go off to bed. And then the next day, we barbecued, and she put on one of the negligees, and we go off to bed. And then it was like the third or fourth day. I was so pleased with how it was going. I knew the guys at the bar were wondering how it was going, so I stopped by to tell them. And one thing leads to another, and time is, you step outside of time in a bar. I've never figured it out, but I looked up and it was midnight. And I thought, my God, I can't go home now. We'll just fight. So for her sake, I'll wait till 2. So they closed the bar at 2 and I drove home. And I'm thinking, you know, you're really selfish. You're really selfish. That girl's crazy about you. And she bought those negligees and thing. And here you are going to deprive her of you. So I went home. Well, she had this thing she used to wear. It looked like that curtain back there, and it was brown. And it like started at the neck, and it went down to the floor, and it went out to, you know, out to here. And basically what it meant was not tonight. That's basically what it meant. Looked like a buffalo robe. And she had this buffalo robe on. Well, I'm a pretty sensitive guy, and I'm easily hurt, and I don't react well when I'm hurt, and I sort of lost it, and I began throwing everything around the apartment. I was turning over furniture, just going nuts, and she was taking pills that this psychiatrist had given her. She was having an affair with this psychiatrist. I knew it, and they were waiting for me to mess up so they could send me away and get rid of me, and when she took these pills, her eyes looked in different directions at the same time. It's an amazing thing, and so when I started throwing these things around, she grabbed her matching buffalo robe house coat and grabbed her purse and ran out. And I knew what she was going to do. She was going to go call this psychiatrist and said, "We got him." And he was going to say, "Call the police." You know, the routine. Well, I was born at night, but it wasn't last night. So I ran in and I took off my clothes. And I used to have these pajamas I wore when the police came. And I put on the pajamas and I messed my hair up, you know, and I brushed my teeth and I gargled with mouthwash. And the doorbell rang. And I put on my house coat and I went and I looked through that little peephole, you know. And there she is, wrapped up in her buffalo robe. And behind her are two county policemen. There was a young guy, about 21, and an old guy, about 30. And I gathered myself, and I pulled the door open, and I said, "Thank God you found her." Yeah. And the older policeman said, "Sir, may we come in?" I said, "Please do." I said, "I'm beside myself with worry." So she came in, and she had that look. You know that look. And I said to her, "Tell me, honey, did you call the doctor?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Well, thank God, if you have to run out of here in the middle of the night, at least you called the doctor." And she started to cry, and she ran into the bedroom. And the older cop reached over and hit me on the arm, and he said, "You hang in there, son." I said, "Yes, sir." And they left. And you know, that's really crazy, but that's not what's sad. You know, what's sad is what happened after that. I went and got her a glass of wine, and she got another one of those pills. And I went into the bedroom, and I had a drink for myself and a glass of wine for her. And she was sitting on a bed, and the big tears were just dripping off her cheeks, just big, big crocodile tears. And she said to me, "Can you forgive me for embarrassing you like that?" And I said to her, "Honey, you can't help it. I mean, you're just having a bad time." You know, you know, she took that buffalo robe off and put on a negligee, and we went to bed that night and made love. And we were convinced we were the luckiest people in the neighborhood. We were stark, raving, insane. And we were convinced we were the luckiest people in the neighborhood. And that's the saddest thing about alcoholism, is what it does to... You know, the big book talks so much about delusion and how deluded, absolutely deluded we were about what we felt for one another and all the rest of it. Well, you know, you can't live like that for long, and she asked me to leave, and I won't bore you with it, but I went where I needed to go, which was to the zoo and to the basement of a house in a Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and to drinking around the clock, and within 6 months, all the controls were off, and I was gone. I was just absolutely gone, and on May the 13th, 1973, the only thing left for me to do was to end my life, and I walked into what passed as a bathroom in this place I was living in, and I had a bunch of pills. I had worked in hospitals, and they used to give you pills, and I never took them. I was afraid of them. I know some of you junkies think that's the saddest story you ever heard, but I just never took them, and I had a whole medicine cabinet full, and I decided I'd take them all. And I said, I made one statement. I said, "You're 29 years old, and at least it'll be over." And this voice, a woman's voice outside of me, said, "It's not supposed to be over. It's supposed to be starting." And I jerked and I looked around. I knew somebody was standing there and they weren't. And at the same time, my mind cleared up, instantly cleared up. And I remember that my ex-wife had given me a phone number and said, "I can't help you. Maybe these people can if you ever want help." She gave me two numbers and I could only find one. And I called it, and it happened to be a little treatment center. Now, I hear a lot of people say bad stuff about treatment centers, which is intriguing to me because we don't have opinions on things. But I got to tell you, I called this place, and all I know is they saved my life. That's all I know. I didn't know where else to go. I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous existed until they took me. And they told me to wait, you know, there'd be 3 days before I could get in there, and I had to get some money, which is not easy to do. I was I was temporarily strapped. And so I had, all I had to my name was an alcoholic car. And so I was driving around to banks trying to get a loan on this alcoholic car. And I needed $300, and they finally loaned it to me. It was a bad deal on their part. But the problem was I was hearing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony for 3 days. It was coming out of the radiator of the car. It was coming out of parking meters. And it's a lovely piece of music the first 6-8 hours. But and I remember I'm sitting in a bank trying to talk to this guy, and I hear Beethoven's Fifth Symphony going. And I knew they didn't have Muzak. I was the only guy hearing this stuff, and I knew that much. And then I began to see those things, and all of a sudden I realized that it was I was supposed to go to this place. It was a few days later, and I'll never forget that day as long as I live. I couldn't drive more than a mile. I had what they used to call the running fits, and now they call them anxiety attacks, but I didn't have good insurance, so there were the running fits. And I'd get out of the car, and I'd be sick, and I wet my pants, and you know, I'm changing my pants outside the car, outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out. And I wondered what had gone wrong. I mean, they kept talking about this kid with all the promise and all the rest of it. And it took me 6 hours to drive 30 miles. And I got there. And I knew they were going to put me in bed, and they didn't. What they did was they put me on a bus, and they took me to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, which I never knew existed. And I worked in medical centers, and I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous existed. And I had no idea what it was about, but they told me that it's a place where drunks hang out. And I couldn't imagine what I was going to see. But I got off that bus, and I walked up, and there was a guy standing at the door, an old guy. Everybody was old in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now there are a lot of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. But back then, everybody was old. And this old guy was standing by the door, and he was what they called a greeter. And he had this really obnoxious habit of looking in your eyes, you know. I was a shoe person. I looked at shoes. But this guy would look me, wherever I looked, I thought he had two heads. Wherever I looked, his head was there. And then he said to me, "You're new, aren't you?" And I thought, oh, my God, he's psychic. And he shook my hand, and he said something that was very strange. He said, "You know, son, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again." And I just wanted to scream at him, "You don't know me. I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his baby. Don't tell me I'll never drink again." Yeah. But, of course, he knew something I didn't know, and that is that he knew that you were here. And you're my miracle. The reason I'm sober today is because of you. And that's just the way it is. It's no more complicated than that. And he took me inside, and he had me sit down next to an old woman. She's 10 days older than dirt. And she got me a half a cup of coffee, and she sat there and patted me through the whole meeting, and, you know, and, "You want a cookie?" "No, thank you." And my skin was moving around, and she's patting me, and then this old face just exploded into a marvelous grin and said, "You know, son, you keep coming here, you never have to be alone again." And I just burst into tears. I swear to you, I didn't know what I was alone. I never knew that. And she put her arm around me, and I put my head on her shoulder, and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I'm telling you, I was never a guy anybody would have guessed would come here, and I certainly wasn't a guy anybody guessed would have stayed here. But something happened inside of me. It happened deep, deep, deep down inside of me. Long before I was sure I was an alcoholic, and certainly long before I thought I could not drink, I fell madly in love with you. What you are, who you are, and what you stand for. I just fell in love with you. And I couldn't get enough of you. It was amazing. But I knew that I couldn't stay sober. I knew Alcoholics Anonymous couldn't work for me. I just knew it. But I didn't need to believe it would work for me because I had a sponsor who believed it would work for me. And his name was Dan. And I called Dan. And every day I'd say, "Dan, you sure this will work for me?" He said, "I'm positive." I said, "You sure?" He said, "I'm positive." I said, "Okay." And it got to the point where I'd just call him. I wouldn't even tell him who I was. I'd just say, "You sure?" He'd say, "Positive." I said, "Fine." I'd hang up. "It's fine." That's all I needed. Yeah. And I began this process. And we were talking yesterday. And I had an experience that changed my life. I've had many of those. But this one, I was sober 4 weeks. I got out of this treatment center. And I went to a meeting in town where I lived. And I lived on Skid Row for 2.5 years after I got sober. But it became a nice place. I painted it and did things, and became a nice place. But I was financially destroyed, so it took me a while to get back. But I started going to meetings in town, and I walked in this meeting, and a man named Dick L. met me at the door. He walked up to me, and he said, "I don't believe I know you." And I said, "Well, my name's Keith." And he said, "Oh," he said, "we're glad to have you here." He said, "Are you kind of new in AA?" I said, "No, I've been here almost 5 weeks now." And he said, "Oh, that's nice." And then he asked me some questions, you know, just not obnoxious questions, just like, do you have a job? Yeah, where do you work? Well, that's nice. And do you have any children? I said, "Well, I have Kelly and Kimberly, but I'm not allowed to see them yet." And he said, "Well, you know, you stay sober, and one day that'll be okay." And we talked for a little while, and then he did a strange thing to me. He took me over and introduced me to some men, and he told them that I was his new friend. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. And he introduced me to a man named Dan, who later became my sponsor, and a man named Bill, and a man named David, and a man named Art. And I can tell you what they were wearing. It was such a significant. I mean, it was over 25 years ago, and I can tell you what they had on. That's what that moment meant to me. But the amazing thing was, 1 week later, I walked back in that meeting, and this man, Dick, walked over and said, "Keith, how are you?" He said, "Have you been sober all week?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you're well into your sixth week now, aren't you?" I said, "Oh, yeah." And he said, "How's Kelly and Kimberly doing? Have you been able to see them?" And I said, "No, but I talked to them on the phone." And then he asked me how my job was. And he asked me questions that told me that he remembered what I told him the week before. And I can't tell you what that meant to me. And I was launched into a way of life that was, the first year was mad. I was one of those people who couldn't sleep. I was a madman. I just couldn't sleep. And back then, they never asked questions in meetings like, "Does anybody here have a problem?" It was a basic assumption that everybody there had a problem. Yeah. But at the end of the meeting, you ever see, that's really something. We do that now. Anybody here have a problem? And the sickest person in the room puts up their hand. My mother had a square nipple. So 50 untrained psychiatrists give their opinion on that. Anyway, that's another topic. But at the end of the meeting, they would like have a topic. And at the end of the meeting, they would say, "Does anybody here want to say something that they might drink over?" I put my hand up. They'd say, "What is it now, Keith?" I'd say, "I can't sleep." And they'd take turns, these old-timers, take turns saying, "Nobody ever died from not sleeping, you know." And finally, one night, I mean, you don't want to talk that way to somebody who hadn't slept. One night, I just jumped up and screamed that, "No, nobody, but people die from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping." You know, the last time I heard it, as a matter of fact, just a crazy man. And I used to run around looking, I couldn't sleep, so I'd drive around Washington all night. I'd just get in my car and drive around. And I'd read all the stuff on, like, Jefferson Memorial, Lincoln Memorial. And I could never remember what I read. So the next day, it was like it was brand new to me. So one night, I went off to the Jefferson Memorial. It was in late June. And so I'd been sober 6, 8 weeks, something like that. And I went up, and I'm reading. And I laid down in the grass and looked at the stars. I fell sound asleep. Well, I woke up. I was thrilled. It wasn't that I couldn't sleep. It was just I hadn't been sleeping in the right place. So I ran home, I got a sleeping bag, I came back and I rolled it out on the grass, and I laid there, I'm looking at the stars, I went right to sleep. And then pretty soon somebody's kicking my foot, and it was a park policeman. And he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'll tell you what I'm doing here," and I told him my story. And he said, "No kidding, this is the only place you can sleep?" I said, "It's the only place I found I can sleep." And he said, "I'll tell you what, buddy," he said, "you ever need to sleep," he said, "you come down here." And so every few days when I needed to sleep, I'd take my sleeping bag to the Jefferson Memorial, and I'd roll it out, and I'd be laying there, and I'd hear, "Hey, Keith, is that you?" I'd say, "Yeah, yeah." They'd say, "How many days?" I said, "68 days. That's great." I said, "So you want some coffee?" I said, "No, I better get some sleep. I have to go to work." So they'd say, "Don't worry. We'll keep an eye on you." And that's how I slept. And it was just mad. And get by. I'm on a 12-step call with my sponsor, who knows everything there is to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. He's smarter than your sponsor, I'll tell you that. And we got to the D.C. jail, and there was a guy on the other side of this real thick yellow glass. You know, it was yellow from the smoke. Dan's chatting away on this phone, and I can hear Dan, but I can't hear this guy at all. And Dan talked to him like 45 minutes. And then he said to him, he said, I got a friend with me. He said, his name's Keith. He said, he's doing real well. He's sober about 3 months now. He's doing really well. I'm going to let him talk to you for a couple of minutes. And I'm thinking, a couple of minutes? I got a lot to say to this guy. So I grabbed the phone and I began to preach to this guy as fast as I could. And finally, the guy stopped me. He said, whoa, wait a minute. He said, buddy, he said, I'll be honest with you. He said, this AA crap's fine for a cretin like you. He said, but I'm a Fulbright scholar. And I just lost it. And I began to scream, well, Mr. Fulbright scholar, one of us is leaving here in a few minutes, and the other was going back to a cell. What do you think of that, Mr. Fulbright scholar? And Dan realized it wasn't going well, and he tried to get the phone away from me, but I wasn't finished yet. And so I'm down on the ground, cradling the phone, screaming at this guy, and the people in the next booth began to look in ours, and finally the guards came and began to look in there, and Dan got the phone away from him, and he said to the guy, he said, yeah, I'll be back tomorrow. Yeah, I'll come alone. And he hung up the phone, and I knew I was going to be kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, the funniest thing, we went out to the parking lot, and I just knew it. It was over. And Dan didn't say anything. It'd make you crazy when they do that. And so finally I said to him, I said, that was pretty bad, wasn't it? And you know what he said? He said, well, I'll be honest with you, Keith. He said, most guys wouldn't have done it that way. He said, but you're going to discover that you develop your own technique in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the last time I heard anything about it. You know, I look back at the great things I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think the first year I was sober, the thing that was most impressive to me was a piece of information. And I used to go to the old-timers, and I'd ask them things, which is a big mistake, because they tell you stuff. And I remember I had this big problem. I used to have a problem a month. And this was a big problem. I think it was June or July of 73, I forget which. And it was that I was sexually impotent, which will put a crimp on your sex life. And I didn't want to tell my sponsor, because I didn't think he'd want to sponsor a guy who was impotent. So I made a mistake of going to this old-timer. And he just had a great, you know. And he said, a lot of us had that problem. It'll get better. I said, when? I thought it was important, you know. He said, what, you got a full social calendar? And so about a month later, I had another big problem. I go back to the same guy. You think I'd learn, you know. And so I went to this guy, and he said, I told him my problem. He said, I want you to do something for me. I said, anything. He said, I want you to go borrow lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, now, I don't want you doing anything else with the girls in the program. He said, oh, that's right, you can't. You know, and so I want you to borrow some lipstick, and I want you to go home and write on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image, and I need to be affirmed. Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They hadn't read any of those books. And he said, do it. So I went and bought a tube of lipstick. I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, especially a woman. And so I went home and I wrote on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I threw the lipstick away, and I was just disgusted. I said, these people are crazy. This is nuts. So I went to bed and had a normal night. Remember a normal night at 60 days? Oh, you know. I lay down, and for the first time that day, my mind woke up, and it took off, you know. You're never going to make it. They're going to find out you're crazy. You're not an alcoholic. You're really crazy. And then they're going to kick you out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent. Just on and on and on. You know? And then the leg cramps. Remember the leg cramps? God, they had leg cramps. And I'd be jumping up and down beside the bed, you know. And 15 minutes before I had to go to work, I'd go sound asleep. And it would take 3 alarm clocks to wake me up, you know. And I'd be so depressed. I'd go out and I just wanted to cry. And I'd be saying to myself, they're going to fire you today because they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and what difference does it make? You're hopelessly in debt. And so I'm making coffee. I just wanted to die. I was so depressed. I went in the bathroom and I looked on a mirror and said, Keith, you're wrong. I said, well, I'm glad of that, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. And so the great piece of information I learned when I was newly sober was that I'm wrong. And I'll tell you, if you're kind of new, the more stuff we can be wrong about, the freer we're going to be. It's not about being right. It's about being wrong. And I used to fight to be right. I would fight to be right in a bootleg joint. Now, that place was not frequented with a bunch of scholars. But I had to be right. Even in a bootleg joint, I had to be right. It was just insane, this selfishness and self-centeredness. Absolutely insane. And Alcoholics Anonymous is all about getting free of all of that. And I remember, I figured out early on what a sponsor did. You know what a sponsor does? Is a sponsor finds out what you want to do and then tells you you can't do it. That's what sponsors do. I figured that out early, you know. And, you know, I was sober about 3 months, and I got a letter from probably the greatest cytologist alive at the time. His name was Jerome Lejeune. And he invited me to come and study a staining technique with him. And he was at the University of Paris Medical School in Paris, France. And I knew that my sponsor wouldn't let me go. I was supposed to go over there New Year's Eve, 1994. And I wasn't even going to ask him. I was just going to refuse it and not give him the satisfaction of telling me I couldn't go. But I figured, what the heck? So we went to lunch. I paid, and I gave him the letter. And he just beamed. He said, "My God, this is wonderful." I said, "You mean I can go?" He said, "You have to go." He said, "This isn't about you." He said, "The best you could do is crap your pants on Skid Row." He said, "This is about Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "This is the difference between having God in your life and not having God in your life. This is the difference between having a sponsor that puts up with you and not having a sponsor. This is the difference between drinking and not drinking." He said, "This has got nothing to do with you." You know, he said, "You have to go." And then he told me something, which is just a marvelous piece of information. He said, "You know, Keith, you can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you prepare properly." He said, "We have 3 months to prepare you to go to France." And he said, "When you get on that airplane to go, you're going to be ready to go, and you're going to stay sober a day at a time over there just like you do here." And you know, 3 months later, I got on an airplane, and I landed in Orly Airport. And fortunately, I was in a seat by myself next to the window because I just couldn't keep from crying as I came down out of the clouds free. And I stayed up as late as I could and toasted everybody with a bottle of Perrier water beside my bed. And I lay down and went to sleep. And I woke up the next morning, sleeping about 3 or 4 hours, my standard fare. And I walked the streets of Paris free. And I watched a baker put out his ware, and I watched the butcher put out his ware. And I walked the streets of Paris a free man. With 6 months of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to understand that being sober means being free. Not just free of debt and free of warrants and all that stuff, but mostly free of self. Free of the tyrant of self. And I had a wonderful time over there, and my sponsor happened to come through Paris. I don't know how you figure it, but he came through Paris and he spent a week with me, and it was one of the great weeks of my life. And then I went on to Rome, and I stayed in a monastery. Somebody said, "Why'd you go stay in a monastery?" And the answer was, "Because I've always wanted to." And what being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous means is that I can live my heart's dreams. And I can be grateful every day, recognizing that God's doing for me what I can't do for myself. And so I was launched into this way of living, that it isn't all about having good things happen to you, certainly. But it's a lot about work, and it's a lot about service, and it's a lot about doing for others. The freedom in Alcoholics Anonymous comes from doing for others, and after we clean our own house. And I went to work cleaning my house and had a lot of experiences. But I'd like to talk, if I may, about the experience I had with my parents. My father, God bless him, will be 86 years old tomorrow. And what a wonderful man. And he, like I say, he raised 11 of his own children and other kids who had no place to go. And I couldn't make amends to my father. I couldn't figure it out. I remember I'd pray and I'd drive from Washington, D.C., where I got sober, to Ohio, where he was living. And I'd spend 5 minutes with that man, and I'd be so angry, I'd get up and I'd storm out, get in my car, and drive back to Washington. And I'd say to my sponsor, "It's not working. It's not working." And so what my father said to my mother during that time was, "I'm worried about that boy." He says, "He drives a long way for a cup of coffee." And I kept praying and kept praying and kept praying. And one day, I had a little house down at the ocean. And name it was CZ Does It. And it's after I moved to North Carolina, and I had a house down at the ocean. And my dad had never seen the ocean because he had a lot of kids to raise. And he had never been on a vacation in his life, and so he came down, and we took him down to the ocean. He was just amazed, and I asked him. I took a position as an officer in a corporation in Birmingham, and I said to him, "Dad, I don't want to leave the house empty. Would you mind keeping an eye on it for me?" So he and my mom kept an eye on my beach house. Kept an eye on it for 6 years, as a matter of fact. But he finally got a vacation, and And I stopped by to see him, and I was troubled. I was sober about 12 or 13 years, and I was just troubled. I didn't know what was wrong, but just troubled. And I know now that 12 and 13 years is often a difficult time for us. And I realized what I'd been chasing was what I thought I would make me happy. So I had not drifted away from AA. I've never done that, but I had drifted away from the spiritual walk in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd gotten too material, and I sat down to talk to my father, and we began to talk, and he gave me some advice. He said, "You know, son," he said, "you've gone further than I ever have already." And I'm thinking, there's no way I could ever be the man that you are. And he said, "But why don't you talk to those friends of yours in Alcoholics Anonymous? They've never steered you wrong." And I thought about it, and you never had. You had never steered me wrong. And then he told me a story. And I would have told you that my father never told me he loved me. And I would have even told you that I don't think he particularly liked me. And he told me this story. He said, "Remember when you went to work, your very first job?" I said, "Yeah, I was 12 years old." I said, "I set pins in the bowling alley." He said, "Yeah." He said, "Down at Lamont's Bowling Alley in Bridgeport." He said, "Do you remember the first day you went to work?" And I said, "I don't think so." And he said, "I took you to lunch." I said, "You did?" He said, "Yeah, I took you to Louis' hot dog stand." He said, "Do you remember what you had for lunch?" And I said, "I'm going to go out on a limb, Dad, a hot dog." And he said, "Of course you had a hot dog, you loon." He said, "Do you remember what you drank?" And I said, "Oh, orange pop. I always drank orange pop." He said, "Not that day." He said, "That day you drank root beer, because I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who drank root beer." And he said, "And I took you to the bus station, and I said to you, 'Son, do you want me to come with you the first day?' And you told me, 'No thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself.'" And he said, "I saw my 12-year-old boy, a scrawny little kid, get on the bus. And he said, "I watched the bus till it was out of sight, and you never looked back." And he said, "From that time on, you never let me do anything for you." He said, "You bought your own clothes." He said, "All your brothers and sisters let me help them through college, but you never let me help you through college or anything." And I realized the great damage I'd done to the relationship I had with my father was I never allowed him to do what he was best at, and that was to be my father. And you know, a couple of months later, I needed to borrow a few $1,000s, and I went to my father, and he loaned me a few $1,000s. From that day till this, we've been very, very close friends. You know, and I looked at Dumb Denny, I was going to go make amends with Dumb Denny, and so I drove up to New Jersey where he was living at the time, and we started to talk, and his wife Jan, I think, knew that this was a different kind of a talk, and she excused herself and went to bed, and I began to tell Denny why I owed him an amends, and I said, "You know, it's hard to have a brother like you who does everything once," and I said, "You know, you're such a success and everything," and he looked at me incredulously, and he said, "I can't believe this conversation." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "I admire you more than anybody in the world." He said, "Nothing's ever stopped you." He said, you don't give a damn about anything. He said, "If you're not doing well in one country, you'll go to another country." He said, "You don't care." And he said, "I've always been afraid to quit. I've always been afraid to change." And he said, "You've always been my example." And I discovered that Denny and I weren't good and bad. We were just different. We're different kinds of people. And he could spend 29 years with AT&T. I couldn't spend 20. I'd be nuts in 29 months in AT&T. And we're just different people, and we love one another just that way. I can't help but think about that ninth step and think about my mom and my brother Terry. My brother Terry was alcoholic. The day that I celebrated my 20th AA birthday, Terry passed away. But he was sober, and I think back to that and how you taught me how to live. Terry had cancer, and he was in the hospital, I had never been able to make amends to Terry because whenever I'd come home, Terry'd leave town. Terry had 90 days a couple times in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just never, the miracle never happened for him. I don't understand it, and it's none of my business, but I miss Terry very much. I loved him very, very much, and I could never get close to him because he was drunk and I wasn't. And my parents celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary, and I finally had an opportunity to make amends to Terry. He came to the celebration and he was drunk and he was late and he was drunk. And my brothers and sisters came to me and said, "I'm in charge of drunk in a family." And they came to me and said, Terry's drunk. And I said, of course he's drunk. He's an alcoholic. And they said, well, he shouldn't be here drunk. And I was able to say to them, you know how much he must love Mom and Dad to be here like that. And I knew exactly what Terry went through. I knew he was down the street in a bar trying to get the courage to go into that room with all of us. And it freed everybody up, and they just accepted Terry the way he was, drunk. And I look at those pictures now. I have one on my mirror at home, and I look at those pictures, and we're all standing there with my mom and dad, and Terry's passed out with his head on my shoulder. And I was able to make amends to my brother Terry, and then he contracted cancer shortly after that, and he was in the hospital. And I made a great discovery. I went to see Terry, and he couldn't run away because he was in the hospital. And he said to me, he said, I can't get away now, can I? And we laughed. And Terry and I talked the way brothers talk at times like that. And he asked me about, he said, you're really happy sober, aren't you? And I said, I am. And he said, you know, I didn't drink, but I could never get happy that way. And I said, I understand. And then he said, you learn a lot about God in there, don't you? And I said, well, I learned about the God of my childhood, and Alcoholics Anonymous freed me up to do that. And he said, could you talk to me a little bit about your God? And I was able to explain to him about the God we grew up with, and about forgiveness, and about love, and about eternity. And he asked me about my rosary, and I just happened to have an extra one, and things like that. And we talked. We talked for a couple hours about things that brothers need to talk about. And you know, after I was sober, I went back to school and I took a degree in theology and philosophy. And I always thought I didn't learn anything in theology that did me any good, but that's, of course, not true. And I got to hug my brother Terry. And let me tell you, you know, for many times we spend so much time regretting the time we've wasted. And I learned something in theology about time. And what it says is that there are two kinds of time. There's something the Greeks called chronos, or chronological time, which is linear. Okay, and I'm about out of that. And then there's another kind of time called kairos, which is God's time. And God's time is always now. And that's why I can never meet God in the future, and I can't meet Him in the past. I can only meet Him in the now. And that's why you taught me to live my life in the now. And I hugged my brother Terry. I just hugged him for a few minutes. He was very frail and sickly, and he'd been a great boxer and things at one time. He was probably one of the toughest guys I ever knew, but alcoholism and cancer had wasted him, and I hugged him, and I just hugged him for a few seconds, but I hugged him forever in God's time. So if you're worried about your family and things like that, don't. We've always got forever in God's time. You know, a couple years later, my mother contracted cancer, and she was dying, and she had a beautiful and a long and painful death. And it was beautiful because she considered pain as a prayer, and she offered her pain to God for all her children. And to see her was an amazing thing, and we became great friends, and I loved her very much and admire her as much as any human being I've ever known. And she so loved you. And she loved what you mean to me. When I was sober about 4 years, I got a chip, and she saw it, and she loved it, and she said, could you get me one of those? So every May the 13th, I'd send them a token. And she took about 6 months to die, and she did all the things like pick what she wanted to wear and all that stuff. And she made a list with my sisters of the things she wanted in her coffin. And the first thing on the list was my 23-year chip. Alcoholics Anonymous changes everything in your life if you work at it. I'm going to tell you one story, and then I'm going to sit down and shut up. I know one of the problems that a lot of us have when we come in here early, and maybe later, is something called guilt. And guilt is not from God, that much I know. I was sober a couple months, and I was overwhelmed with guilt about my children. I couldn't see them, and on and on and on and on. And one day, I don't know if I'd have drank or not, but I just didn't know how I could continue to live the way I was living. And I'd been to a meeting, and I went for coffee after the meeting. And a man led the meeting named Harold. And he called himself Happy Harold. And I didn't know him, but he led the meeting. And I was leaving, and he noticed me. And, and,
Harold was an old-timer, and old-timers can read us. And he saw me walking out, and he called me over, and he said, "Son, I don't believe I know you." And he shook my hand. He's a beautiful man. He's a black man, and intense eyes. And he said, "What's the problem?" And I began to tell him about guilt and how guilty I felt. And he said, "Yeah, guilt's an awful thing." And he told me this story. He said that his mother was dying, and she was in intensive care, and she called the children and said, "I want you to come and see me tomorrow because I won't be here long and I want to say goodbye to you." And she said, "But Harold, if you're drinking, don't come because I don't want to go into eternity seeing my boy drunk." And he said, the next morning I went to the hospital and he said, "I was drunk." And I said, "You were?" He said, "Of course I was drunk, Keith." He said, "I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics drink. Until the miracle happens, alcoholics drink." And he said, "My brothers and sisters said, you can't go see him. Can't go see Mom." And so he called up and he said, "Mama, can I come up and see you?" And she said, "If you're drinking, Harold, no." And he said, "So while my brothers and sisters say goodbye to my mama," he said, "I sat in a waiting room downstairs." And I said, "My God, Harold, how do you live with that?" And he smiled at me the way Harold can smile, and he said, "You're going to discover something, boy. He said, you're going to discover that the worst thing you've done becomes your greatest gift." And I didn't think much more about it. And I guess a few months later, I was in the hospital, and I saw Harold standing by the elevator. And I went over and talked to him for a couple of minutes, and he got on the elevator and left. And his nurse came over to me and said, "Do you know Mr. B?" And I said, "You mean Harold?" And she said, "He's the finest man I know." And I said, "Oh, why is that?" And she said, "You know, whenever we have somebody here who's all alone and doesn't have anybody and are dying, we call Harold, and he comes and helps them die." Those words rang through my mind. The worst you do becomes your greatest gift. So I invite you, if you're here tonight, and if you're still in a stage where you hate yourself and you think that life can never get better and you can never get even or all the rest of it, I'm telling you, the thing that you most hate in yourself this very moment will become the gift that another human being needs. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what service is all about. That's what the 12 steps are all about. And that's what being part of God's army is all about. In memory of Sister Victoria, I just want you to know, if you don't know, God loves you. Thank you.